U.S. history as well. It's not just in Colorado. So the fact that 1,000 homes burned to the ground is remarkable. And comparing to Oregon and California, I think one thing that's really important to note here is that this is a winter wildfire, and that is an oxymoron. There's only one other time in my career when I've talked about snow putting out wildfires. And so this to me is an important signal, and we've seen this signal across the West. We know that since the 1980s, the amount of forests that have burned has doubled, and that's directly tied to how warm our temperatures are and essentially how dry our fuels have become. We've known that there's a link between climate change and wildfires for over a decade, and it takes just a little bit of warming to lead to a lot more burning, and that's what we're seeing. You know, we no longer have a fire season. We have fires all year round. And, you know, this wildfire is small relative to some of the fires in California and Oregon that happened over this summer and happened over the last summer. It's 6,000 acres relative to some of the biggest wildfires we've seen in the lower 48. We saw a 1 million-acre fire over the last couple of years. So this is a small fire, but what made it a disaster is that there are a lot of homes in the way. And that has to do with our development patterns and how we're building into flammable landscapes. There's a lot we can do to change how we build into flammable places.
What can be done?
So we need to rethink how we're building. There's a lot of materials that we can use that are not as flammable. So when we build with wood siding and asphalt roofing and wood decks, those are all flammable materials. We have building codes that make us install sprinklers and inside homes and inside industrial buildings, but we don't have the equivalent building codes to protect our homes from wildfires. California is on the leading edge of this, and now other states need to think seriously about how we're building homes into flammable places. All of Colorado is flammable. Our grasses are flammable, our shrubs are flammable, our trees are flammable. This is a dry landscape that's flammable most of the year now. And so we need to rethink how we're building into these places.
And the drought. Can you talk about the effect of what this historic 20-year drought before the wildfire? From July to December, Denver recorded the lowest amount of precipitation.
Yeah, so moisture is another huge factor. So it's not only temperature increase, it's also how much moisture we're getting. And we didn't get a lick of moisture in this region before this wildfire started. And so how much rain or snow we get plus warm temperatures essentially equates to really, really dry fuels and dry over a period of time. And not only that, but the plants are stressed out. And so they die and they become dead fuel to burn, which is much more flammable. I mean, essentially what happened with this fire in the first few hours was that it moved through an open space that was essentially a grassland. It had an entire runway of grass to go through for several miles before it started to hit neighborhoods. And essentially what that meant was there was a very long active fire line that was moving towards those homes in very dry fuels.
What do you say to climate change deniers like, Colorado's own Congress member Lauren Boebert?
Oh, it's frustrating. The science has been known for over a decade that there's a link between warming and wildfires, and we need to move past it and acknowledge it in order to build solutions. You know, we're essentially sitting ducks to the repercussions of climate change if we don't acknowledge it. And I think part of the solution is acknowledging it and figuring out how we can live with increasing fire in the future. We're going to build back, but I hope that Colorado builds back smarter, thinking about how we can build more fire-resilient homes and fire-resilient communities moving forward.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Jennifer Balch, director of the Earth Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
from RCT, In Sound, from Way Out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Oliver Stone regarding his new documentary film, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass.
This is a crucially important documentary. It points the finger, in my personal opinion, at the CIA and particularly its fired director, Alan Dulles, on the assassination of JFK. And what happened after that has changed the course of American history.
We also take a look at the trend to privatize waste and water utilities. We'll talk with two National Lawyers Guild attorneys about the financial and environmental consequences. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963. That's 58 years ago. That assassination is a political murder, of course, and his murder was a turning point in American history. The first question needed to be asked in a murder case is why? The second question, of course, is who? Today we discuss this catastrophic turn in American history with filmmaker Oliver Stone, who directed his just-released new documentary, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass. Stone uses evidence from the Assassination Record Review Board to bolster our understanding that the assassination was not accomplished by a lone individual, Lee Harvey Oswald. Kennedy was killed because he was pushing for a detente. He wanted to end the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. He wanted to get American troops out of Vietnam and end its counter-revolutionary involvement in many places around the world. President Kennedy wanted to reestablish relations with Castro and revolutionary Cuba. He wanted to support the independence of countries like the Congo. It was for this that he was murdered, and the course of American history was changed. One of the first things the new President Lyndon Johnson did, he had been Kennedy's vice president, after he was installed, was to reverse Kennedy's order initiating the withdrawal of American troops in Vietnam. Instead, Johnson escalated the war, eventually putting 500,000 American soldiers on the battlefield in that war, killing some 3 million Vietnamese people, and, of course, over 53,000 American soldiers died in that war as well. Stone's 1991 movie JFK was nominated for 4 Oscars, winning 2 of them. His new documentary, JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, has been pretty much ignored by the mainstream America media. We have greatly admired Oliver Stone for years, and we are proud now to have him as a guest on our show. Oliver Stone, welcome to Law and Disorder Radio. I came away from watching your documentary feeling, number one, clearly, Lee Harvey Oswald, if he had anything to do with it all, it was not the lone shooter, quote unquote. Secondly, the CIA and the FBI seem to be the most likely suspects, if you will, in this. And one also comes away from your film wondering about Lyndon Johnson himself. So what would you say is your own belief, having done all the work and the research you've done for years on this, as to the answer to that question, who effectuated the murder?
It was in the days right after the assassination when Alsop, Joseph Alsop, who was a columnist, a very respected, called Johnson with a suggestion that he had to get an impeccable commission together to prove, to show that Oswald had done it alone. That was always the goal, because Johnson had shared the thought with other people, too, that there was a conspiracy possible behind it, but it could never be revealed because it would be Russia and Cuba, the guilty parties, and he did not want a war. That was what he said on the surface, anyway, that Russia and Cuba possibly were involved, but that there could be no admission of that. And that was really the motivation that drove the Warren Commission. That's what he told Justice Warren, who was the head of the commission, Earl Warren. And it was a pretty convincing argument at the time, I guess, because of the tensions with Cuba and Russia. I think people were cowed by that, and they didn't think it through. Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General, knew that wasn't true because he had contacts with the Russia through very good friends of the Georgi Bolshakov, and soon gave a notice to the Soviet Union, to Khrushchev through his envoy, that Jackie and him knew that it was not their doing, and that it was a probable conspiracy of right-wing people in the United States. That was a message that was passed to Moscow.
What was the conclusion of the Warren Commission?
Well, the commission operated for, almost a year, until November of the next year, or September, I'm not exactly sure, I forgot. There's a lot of details in this thing, that top of the head. The seven members of the commission, it was a strange history, but they convened several times. But Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, was appointed to the commission by who knows who, by Johnson, perhaps, but there was pressures inside to make the appointees. And the appointees were, Alan Dulles was the lead investigator in the sense that he attended all the meetings and had no job at the time because he'd been fired by Kennedy. And it's strange, of course, that he's investigating the man who he hated and a man who had fired him. Mm-hmm. So that's a strange story. But as you know, Warren and Gerald Ford was another one appointed. He was in the House of Representatives. He had been an ex-FBI informant and apparently had great relations with the FBI. Also was John McCloy, who was an establishment figure of some renown and very much admired. And three senators. There was Richard Russell of Georgia, Hale Boggs of Louisiana, and John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky. The conclusions were what Johnson had originally wanted, which is that Lee Harvey Oswald had shot the president alone and that he was responsible, and there was no sign of a conspiracy. There was some disagreement with that. Richard Russell had problems with the bullets, the single bullet theory, among others, as did one or two other people. Russell's dissenting opinion was not included, which is a whole interesting story unto itself. It disappeared from the last day of the meeting of the commission. And Russell was upset, and it's in his papers. We talk about this in the documentary Through the Looking Glass, which you have to understand all these details. And the commission, of course, was supported immediately by the media, which had been tipped off to what they were going to do and had seen inside work. And the New York Times, Washington Post, and the usual trifecta of media supported this completely on day one, that the assassin was Oswald. There was subsequent to that, a few months later, was the 20-some volume of supplementary evidence that they issued, and that is where, of course, so many things are disputed. It was sold to the American public, and it was all the networks, the major networks were involved and said so right away at the top. How they could have read this so fast and absorbed all this material, of course, is a question.
Oliver Stone, the new documentary which you directed, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass, opens with a lengthy, meticulously constructed presentation of the physical evidence demonstrating a conspiracy, that is, something done by more than one person. In a nutshell, how do you show two or more people were involved in the murder of JFK?
These are questions of forensics and ballistics, but we go into some detail with experts. I'm not an expert. I'm the director. I made the original movie, but I used the services of Jim DiEugenio, who is the screenwriter. Jim is a researcher from second or third generation, you might say, and he really has the memory of an elephant. He's read everything and is able to discuss all this in detail. Essentially, all the forensics and all the bullets and all the lack of evidence, the lack of the rifle, the lack of fingerprints, it was a mess. It was a badly, badly done investigation scene. Terrible, in fact. For the most minor murder, there would be more attention to detail in our system. But this was outrageous, and it was never really questioned at the time because it was so dense and the material was complicated, and there was a lot of dissent, And Mark Lane was one of the first people, much to his credit, a great lawyer, was out there on day one and complaining about this, as were Harold Weisberg and Sylvia Marr and several people who got involved early in reading the actual documents. You know, Alan Dulles said famously that no one reads anymore at the time because he wasn't concerned about printing all these volumes. It's kind of a strange story because Dulles had a blithe kind of arrogance about the whole thing. The reason Kennedy had to be killed from both sides was not only the bullets, the bullet traces in him, and that there had to be more than three shots. It's very clear from, among other reasons, you see Kennedy in the Zapruder film, which was not available at that time to be seen, but you see him since then in the Zapruder film grabbing his throat as if he's been shot in the throat from the front right in the beginning. And there's Dr. Malcolm Perry at the Parkland Hospital performed a tracheotomy on his throat and said quietly to his people that it was a shot from the front. But that was, he never testified as such to the Warren Commission because he was intimidated by agents like Elmer Moore, who appears in the documentary. You can see what happened to Malcolm Perry. It's a sad story. We have a friend of his quite close to him who tells us the story. He was so intimidated, and he came back, and one day, as a lawyer, said it doctor to doctor, that the bullet was definitely from the front. Aside from that, you have this magic bullet that the Warren Commission needed to justify three shots, only three shots. They were in a straitjacket after that because three shots could only be fired in the period of time that the Zapruder film allowed. Lee Harvey Oswald could not pull the bolt on that cheap Mannlicher Carcano Italian rifle, and he had to pull it within that time frame of about 6.7 or 8 seconds. He couldn't do it, and that's without aiming. That's just pulling the bolt, firing. Usually the first shot is pretty accurate, but the opposite is true. One of the later shots was the accurate headshot that killed Kennedy. And, of course, they said that the magic bullet was fired from the rear, which it would indicate that his head would be shooting forward, but it isn't in the film. It goes back into the left. You see a tremendous hole, you see a blast take off the back of the head, take off the right side of his head, and there's a gaping wound. At least 40 people saw the right rear of his skull, which is a significant eyewitness thing because that was ignored by the Warren Commission. A lot of those witnesses were not listened to, were not called. So the autopsy in Bethesda it's a strange autopsy because it was controlled by the military, which is not against really the rules. I mean, there was no real autopsy experts there. They were military men, Navy men, and they did what they were told at the autopsy, which was don't go there, don't open that wound. It was kind of a strange autopsy, and filled with people, by the way. The galley was like 20, 30 people in it. Watching, this included Curtis LeMay, who was one of the General Chief of Staff of the Air Force, who was one of Kennedy's enemies, and military people. We don't know who exactly, but they were there and telling them what to do. The official autopsy is very corrupt, and we go into details on that, and the people who saw things that disappeared, saw things that were changed, including the rear head wound. That was patched up in a photograph. How that was done, we can only speculate. You can't be shot from two sides, and the magic bullet is silly unto itself. It's supposed to have created seven wounds, and in both men, which doesn't work if you time it with the timing of the visual evidence of the Zapruder film. It does not work. That magic bullet does not have a mark on it, and it isn't traceable either. There's no chain of custody on it. We go into these details, so for those reasons alone, he had to be shot by more than one person.
Yeah, I was going to say, Oliver, having watched your wonderful documentary, I don't think anybody could watch it and come away not understanding and believing what you've just said to our audience. I mean, it becomes patently clear and laid out beautifully in the documentary. Lee Harvey Oswald, let's talk about him for a minute. Just before he was shot, of course, by Jack Ruby himself, I believe an FBI informer, just before he was shot by Ruby, He made the statement that press were around, everybody's around. I didn't kill anybody, he said. Tell us what we know and what you know and that's significant for this story about Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, it's a very thick file, and you have to see the film, but you know what, essentially with the government's intention, Lyndon Johnson was trying to say that this is important. Oswald was a nutcase, that he was he was not a bona fide assassin in the sense that he was killing a left-oriented president, left-wing president who was talking to the communists. In other words, that would have made Oswald a rabid right-winger, correct? Lyndon Johnson did not want an assassin who was political, essentially, because it would have tipped the scale and pointed to Russia or Cuba, which was a big problem. On the other hand, he didn't want to point the scale at the CIA or the right wing, which was another problem. So he has to fall in the middle. He has to be a nutcase, basically, an unstable young man. But all the evidence that we show and the fingerprints of intelligence are all over this guy since 1958, when he goes to Russia for the first time. He's working with the CIA, not necessarily as an agent, but as some kind of he's an asset that they use. And that seems to be true throughout, the way he comes back to the United States, the way he integrates into the Dallas and the New Orleans communities where he gets these jobs that are assigned to him by people who want him there in those positions. He's not the only one who fits that profile of a loose nut, of a lone nut. There were other people being groomed in other cities, because we find out in the documentary that there was other attempts going on in the fall of 63 on Kennedy's life.
Oliver Stone, who was Alan Dulles? Talk about his background and what his relationship was with Kennedy.
Well, there's a wonderful book about, written by David Talbot, called The Devil's Chessboard, which goes into depth on Kennedy and Dulles. It's all about the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles. They were reactionary figures in American politics with a lot of power. Dulles was head of the CIA. His brother was head of the State Department under Eisenhower. And they had quite a bit of autonomy between them. They ran operations, I would say black ops, that people didn't know about. Eisenhower supported them without knowing too much about it. They had kind of a plausible deniability. They were involved in the murders in Belgian Congo of Patrice Lumumba and in the attempts on de Gaulle's life. CIA was all over the world at this point. They had grown through the 1950s into a major, major government operation that was covert, proving what they were doing. Of course, that's not the point of them. They're supposed to be covert. The problem in the case has always been that the CIA has never cooperated with either with the Warren Commission or with any other commission. When the Assassination Records Review Board, which grew out of my original 1991 film, came into being, they were still holding out documents. I mean, every document, there was nothing revealed to any of these two and three investigations. That includes the House Select Committee on Assassinations and so on. Never revealed anything. CIA stonewalled it all the way through. And the same thing is true to some degree of the FBI and the Secret Service. Mr. Dulles' personal relationship, well, he was humiliated. He was the titan. Him and his brother were running the show, basically, controlling our relations with all countries. We were strongly anti-communist. But not only were we anti-communist, it was Dulles's, the brother's intention to roll back communism by overthrowing, by dirty warfare, by, in other words, destroying the communist menace once and for all. They had been both of them had been in Wall Street. John Foster was a big lawyer with a huge firm. He'd worked very closely with the Germans during World War II. It's a really dirty laundry story of what Dulles brothers did during World War II and after it to try to save the German network of intelligence to use against the Russians right after the war. So, but when Allen got fired, it was a huge hit against the CIA. Huge hit against the brothers, but they took it very personally. The people were shocked. The young president doing that, getting rid of this senior, one of the high priests of American anti-communism. And he did it because of the Bay of Pigs. And you have to go into all that story, because Kennedy found out essentially in these first years that he was not really president of the whole show. It was there was a whole autonomous division of his government that he couldn't control, and that included the military and the CIA. And he told people about it. He said, I'm not sure I'm in charge of this government.
One of the things I learned from your wonderful new documentary, and one I think that's very important because I believe I said at the top of the show, in any murder, and certainly in a political assassination of the magnitude of the Kennedy assassination, one not only wants to know who did it, one wants to know why they did it, and the two are very often related. And I think your film beautifully documents in this regard what I think you believe is as the motivation here. It documents Kennedy's evolution politically after he's elected, both the evolution in his domestic politics and his international politics. What would you say about that?
It's a fascinating story which hasn't been told to the American public. There's a wonderful book which anybody really interested must read. It's David Talbot, again, who wrote prior to Devil's Chessboard about the Dulles brothers. He wrote, it's an amazing story, a lot of detail. If you study Jack's history, he's Irish, first of all. He's not English. So there's a whole thing about Irish independence against the establishment of England. But in the 1950s, he has great sympathy for the French cause of independence in Vietnam. He's an anti-colonialist from the beginning. You must read Brothers, which is crucial to understand. Because Kennedy, in 1960, we had gone through two presidents, Truman and Eisenhower, who had been staunch proponents of the national security state. In other words, after World War II, we had committed to a policy of call it Keynesian militarism, where we would build up the country, we would keep the employment going, we would never go back into a depression from the 1930s by investing in the military economy, which had come about through World War II. So Roosevelt had presided over a depression, and many people argue, you know how much the Republicans hated him. And, of course, he was considered a traitor to his class, but he really was a broad-thinking and Keynesian man who believed in government investment in the economy to keep the pots boiling. Kennedy admired Roosevelt and, in a sense, was trying to bring back the Roosevelt era of good relations with other people. It was Roosevelt who recognized the Soviet Union in 1933. Kennedy was trying to do that, in a sense, bring back an open generosity to our system, as opposed to the close-minded fear, paranoia of the Eisenhower-Truman age. However, when 1960, when he ran for office, he could not run on that. He could not say, I'm going to be a candidate for peace. I'm not going to. He never mentioned that. He had to talk about the Cold War because that was the gripping topic at the time. He never could have beaten Richard Nixon in the election if he had not supported staunch pro-military policies, which is what he did. And any candidate would do that, I guess, to be elected. And some people are very confused by that because he made comments about Cuba, and especially about Cuba, that made people believe that he was a cold warrior in the strictest sense of the word. But he didn't turn out to be, because the moment he got into office, he found out that he was being lied to by the CIA when they told him that they could go into the Bay of Pigs and that the Cuban people would overthrow Castro because there was some simmering discontent with his revolution. They were lying to him, and because they thought that if they went in and were semi-successful at establishing a beachhead in Cuba, that Kennedy, like Eisenhower and like Truman, would certainly send in American troops and Air Force to support the invasion, and it would lead to the overthrow of Castro, which would never have happened because the Cubans were very proud. It would have turned into an insurgency even worse than Iraq. I mean, at that time. Kennedy kind of saw this, and he did not want American troops involved in combat. This is true in Cuba, and above all, people have to understand it's true in Vietnam. He sent advisors to Vietnam in a very difficult situation. He refused several times, 3, 4, 5 times, to send American combat troops to Vietnam. His logic makes perfect sense. If he's not going to go fight with American combat troops in Cuba, why is he going to send them 6,000 miles away to Vietnam? It just doesn't make sense. Kennedy's concerns were Berlin. That was the hot point, Berlin with the Soviet Union. Cuba was the second hot point. Vietnam was the third hot point, gradually became a hot point. So you have to read these books. You have to kind of understand the picture. But essentially, Kennedy was changing into a much more a warrior for peace. And after the missile crisis of 62, which is crucial to understand because that, again, is where the tremendous pressure was brought upon him to invade Cuba like they did in 61, to invade Cuba. They wanted to go in, the chiefs of staff. Risked it with Russia because they had such a stronger nuclear capacity than the Soviets. So we were a continent. In the books, and you'll find that there's a strange meeting in 60. The plan is in 61 or 62 is to have a force capable of attacking first strike on the Soviet Union in 63.
So what would you say is your own belief, having done all the work and the research you've done for years on this, as to the answer to that question, who effectuated the murder?
I would go a little bit slower than that. I cannot say I'm 100% sure. We're looking at all the evidence here, the things that happened that day. For example, it seems very clear now that Oswald was not on the sixth floor at all. In fact, there may not have been any shots from the sixth floor because we point to the story of the three secretaries who were on the fourth floor watching the shooting. They saw it, and they ran down the stairs. Two of them ran down the stairs right away. This was traced by a researcher up to 1996 when they found one of these women who testified again. She was not called by the Warren Commission because she said the same story back in 63, but nobody wanted to hear her. And then they changed on the other woman. They said her times were off. She'd run down the stairs in more than a minute, although she said right away, I ran down those stairs right away. And I was downstairs in probably less than a minute. So how could Oswald have been on those stairs and got out of the sixth floor if he was two stories above them? It doesn't make any sense. In addition to that, there's a policeman coming up the stairs with the janitor of the building, and they don't see Oswald either. And everything kind of falls into a pattern where there's nobody on the sixth floor. And that becomes more and more clear as you follow the evidence. So if Oswald's on the sixth floor, he's on the second floor, which is what he always said he was, I mean, his lunch, it's problematic. And probably the other shooters were somewhere else, probably not in that building, in my opinion, but I can't say for sure. There were shots from the rear, but some people believe it's a Dow Tax building. Some people say it's the roof of the county building. So there's different theories on that, but essentially, there were shots from the front at the fence and from the rear. The shots from the front, there were people seen there. They drove away. It's in my film. It was in the documentary. I didn't bother to repeat some of the stuff in the documentary that we showed in the film.
We could go on for an hour. This is fascinating stuff and so important. But I wanted to ask you a question on a personal level. You and Jim and I were all of an age that we personally experienced the assassination as young adults. What was it that compelled you to try to educate people about what happened to Kennedy and what you've learned?
Well, frankly, I didn't get interested into the case. I accepted the conventional explanation until 1980s. I was given a book as a film director, and it was a very good story, potentially great story. It was a thriller, a Jim Garrison story, and all the stuff he went through in New Orleans. At first, he didn't believe, and then he began to realize that something very important happened because his sense of logic was challenged. And I have to say the same thing is true for me. I mean, the more you go into the case, even on the surface, you see that everything is cockeyed. There's no evidence. And yet the whole country falls into line. So in a sense, yes, I do have a rebellious side. I don't like to be pushed around. I don't like to be bullied by saying you have to believe this in order to work in our society. That's not the way America was built. America is built with argument and dissent, and there has been no allowance for dissent in this case. That's so aggravating that my film, the original film, was attacked brutally, but aside from that, this documentary was completely ignored by the major media. All the press we've gotten has been from the internet press, and it's good. These people are smart. They're thinking for themselves. But that's what's the problem with America now. We're closing off debate on every issue where there's any kind of, it becomes politically very heated and partisan. That bothers me no end. And this is an old case. A lot of tremendously good people have put their lifetime of effort into it, and they're being ignored. I think that bothers me a lot.
Oliver Stone, you've made a great documentary. You directed JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass. It's on Showtime. We urge all of our listeners to get it and look at it, because the implications of the murder of John F. Kennedy resound today and have changed our lives. We thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Oliver.
Okay, good.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. By 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will be out of fresh drinking water, according to the World Bank. Fortune magazine recently called water, quote, the oil of the 21st century. This situation has private companies flocking to privatize water delivery. Rather than helping to protect existing water supplies, to increase conservation measures, stem pollution, and help out needy populations, pressure is mounting to commodify and profit from this natural resource. Similarly, the National Waste and Recycling Association supports privatizing waste and recycling collection services at all levels of government. Privatization often brings rate hikes, decreased water quality, less reliability, and poor customer service. The average U.S. community with privatized water, for example, paid 59% more than those with government-supplied water. New Jersey has more private water systems than most states, and they charge 79% more. Private water corporations have also been implicated in environmental disasters. The French multinational Veolia issued a report in 2015 certifying that Flint, Michigan's water system met EPA standards. It neglected to mention their high lead concentrations. Joining us today are two attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild. Terry Lodge joins us from Toledo, where he specializes in environmental and energy issues. He's associated with the nonprofit Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which offers free and affordable legal services. We're also joined by Lindsay Schroman-Warren, an attorney at Shearwater Law, also affiliated with Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund since 2013. Lindsay serves as a city councilor in Port Angeles, Washington, and is a member of the International Parliamentary Alliance for the Recognition of Ecocide. Terry and Lindsay, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, indeed.
Most Americans probably don't give much thought to where their water comes from, and the same for waste disposal. Can you both summarize briefly some of the environmental issues involved in both industries if they're privatized? And let's start with Terry.
Oh, my. There are a lot of environmental issues just with the industry in general. There's a problem of ancient lead lines, problems of terribly outdated infrastructure, problems of increasing pollution from the source requiring much more expensive treatment, which is astronomically driving up the cost of water in places like where I live in Toledo, Ohio, which draws from Lake Erie, which is becoming increasingly poisoned every year because of a phosphorus overspill. There are many environmental difficulties from being associated with fracking in nearby areas with subsurface water sources in mountainous areas in eastern Ohio and Pennsylvania. I could go on and on. In any event, what privatization, the privatization move that I am seeing here in the Midwest, with there's a corporation called Aqua Ohio that is acquiring small town water systems, and what they are billing themselves as being capable of doing is upgrading a system and bring things into line with modern standards. They aren't talking, for the most part, about replacing lead pipes or any accumulations of heavy metals or things like that in the system. But what they're doing is taking the strain off of small villages and towns that haven't kept up with the times and are unwilling to undergo the financing and reworking to make their water systems effective. So it's a predatory kind of circumstance going on right now.
And Lindsay, are there issues, environmental issues, involved in privatizing waste disposal?
Yeah, I mean, so waste disposal, we're just shipping garbage around, and more small governments don't have their own landfills, and so they end up shipping it to a larger landfill, often over long distances. How that happens is very much determined by who's running the utility. So in the city of Port Angeles, where I'm a council member, we are working on, I guess the opposite of privatization would be publicization. I mean, I'm making up a word there, which is awful because we should be doing it more. When we as a city are actually managing our own solid waste utility, we're going to be able to pick a landfill site that's closer to the city so we don't have to ship the garbage as far, which is going to cut down on fuel costs. So there's a lot of different areas where the small decisions that the utilities are making end up creating larger environmental impacts, whether it's transportation or the quality of the water that people get, or the impact on the land area or water body where the utilities, water or resources coming from. We need these utilities to live in cities. We need to democratize them in order to have control over them and how they impact the environment and the people they support.
Terry, following up on what Lindsay just said in terms of the process of taking it back so it becomes public again, how does privatizing water and waste work? Is it a leasing system or a contract that a city signs with a private company for a number of years?
It's kind of all of the above. Sometimes the privatization occurs after what I guess I would call a trial period, where the local government hands over management to a private firm, and basically it's simply the firm is treated as a contractor. And then ultimately the firm makes an offer to buy out the system. They're obviously familiar with how it works and its status and structure and all that, and the price is negotiated, and that's effectively it. That is kind of the model that I'm seeing used by Aqua Ohio and have seen other privatizers do. On the other hand, about 4 years ago, Aqua Ohio at that time had acquired something on the order of 13 or 14 local small community water sources in northeastern Ohio, and out of the blue, they made an offer of $50 million as a starting negotiating point for the city of Youngstown's system. This is, in my view, an awful lot of this is disaster capitalism. Youngstown has poverty and urban characteristics that are certainly analogous to those of Detroit. And what happens is that the privateer comes on the scene with this rescue plan. We're going to give you a whole bunch of money in exchange for which you either, you know, lease for 100 years or sell us the system outright, something on that order. Fortunately, in Youngstown, there's been a long-time grassroots organization that CELDEF has worked with, and they made a lot of noise and began circulating petitions that were going to amend the charter to make it illegal to sell the system. At that point, the city administration just said flatly that they have no interest in selling the system. But this is, I think, probably going to be an increasing problem as other cities find themselves falling into financial trouble.
Lindsay, I read that workers for privatized sanitation face actually one of the most dangerous jobs in the country. And my question is, what kind of input does a local government have into how a private company not only manages the utility, but, for example, treats their workers or deals with safety concerns?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things we're seeing in local governments today is a resurgence of using the power of cities and counties to protect people's health, safety, and welfare in order to broadly improve worker rights and working conditions and create economic justice. The whole movement around higher minimum wages, you know, came out of the city of SeaTac, Washington, raising wages throughout the city, which included at the international airport for Seattle and Tacoma. You know, so even if those workers weren't unionized or didn't have good benefits at work, they were able to be to have those benefits increased by the city passing a law of general applicability. And, you know, there were sanitation workers in the city. The other way is that the city actually has those people as employees and, you know, compensates them well directly. You know, we know that governments are, you know, more heavily unionized than private sector. And so those are different options. But I do like the trend of cities using their power, passing general laws in order to benefit economic justice for all workers.
And Terry, I'm curious in terms of water systems privatized, how much input does local government have with a private company?
They can negotiate a significant role. The problem is that often, again, when you're talking about acquiring a system from a smaller community, the local government is more focused on just getting the money and where do I sign, is what I kind of think the problem is. Another thing that the company does is they will come in with a guarantee of a certain rate level or certain rate classifications for the first few years, sort of teaser rates, and it takes away some of the arguments and possible resistance that might arise in the city councils or city administrations that are doing the negotiation. This becomes a very conventional, as I say, capitalistic kind of negotiation where the two sides are perhaps focused on really different objectives. And what I'm also hearing and seeing is that after the teaser rates expire, the rates go up tremendously, which is, these kinds of things are an old familiar pattern. It's interesting that in Cochabamba, Livia, some years ago, there was effectively a huge public outcry with the attempted privatization of the system there. That particular privateer came in with elevated rates, with a system that was not so terribly in distress and for which there was not quite the justification for the high rates. But it's clearly something that the people wouldn't stand for, even though their government had very quickly sold out. So it's kind of interesting how this sort of thing is marketed. And as I also watch what's going on in Northeastern Ohio, I do have to mention that, interestingly, Aqua Ohio is trying to become a larger and larger provider of fresh water to support the hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, industry, which is pretty big in that region. And so you actually have a system which is being acquired not to improve customer service, not to particularly maintain any particular high quality of water delivery to the existing customers, but is actually looking to use the water for a particular use that permanently impairs it. It destroys water to use it in injection processes associated with fracking.
That's interesting. I was surprised to read that privatized water companies have fewer Environmental Protection Agency violations, fines, or work orders related to compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, publicly operated systems are much likelier to incur health violations of that act. Is this due to lobbying efforts by the water and waste industries?
One of the time-tested approaches the US EPA has used is the path of least resistance. And I think that public water systems are more vulnerable to charges because there are politics involved, whereas private firms can make it clear that they will pull in platoons of corporate lawyer defenders and make a lot of problems for the outgunned U.S. EPA. That would be my first guess. Another, of course, is yes, big water is becoming bigger and a larger political player in environmental legislation and politics.
Lindsay, I'm curious, is there a lobby for the waste industry, or is that part of the National Association of Water Companies?
Yeah, it's probably at the national level and then also at the state level. I know, you know, the cities all have their own, you know, municipal leagues or city associations at each state, and then those come together, the National League of Cities. But the private waste management companies are often big sponsors of our city conferences, you know, other city events. So they make sure that their advertisement is very visible in the newsletters that we get as city elected officials. You know, they understand that their public face is really vital to having local governments believe that they're getting a better service by having their ratepayers pay a profit to a private company than if the city were actually running the utility itself.
Now, Lindsay, we've all heard about the disaster in Flint, Michigan, with the water systems there. But we don't, or at least I haven't heard that much about environmental threats or harm to the public through waste disposal. Is there an example of sort of a worst-case scenario, what could go wrong in that process?
For me, the big thing with waste disposal is our inability to cut down on the waste stream when we don't have control of the waste disposal, the solid waste utility. So California recently enacted, or it's going into effect in the next month, composting. That's a huge way to reduce the waste stream. But if your utilities aren't getting ready for that, it's going to have to be a very top-down process. And if you don't have control of the state legislature, then that's not going to happen in your state. So then you're like, okay, we need a local government that's willing to go forward and enact recycling or, say, composting as a part of the utility. You know, that's going to be a lot harder if you don't control the operations of the utility. So that's kind of how I've been thinking about the importance of public control of our utilities. And that has to do then with, you know, how much are the city staff or county staff, depending on, you know, where you are and what's going on, willing to do the work to maintain that as a public entity. I think what often happens with privatization is there's been neglect at the public level, you know, usually unintentionally, because basically there's not enough funding for infrastructure. And that's a common story that we all know about. So then the utility falls into decline, and here comes this rescue package in the form of a private company that says, hey, we'll manage the utility and take all that headache away from you. And the city bureaucrats say, that sounds great. We'll sell it to our council.
And I've seen in some of the literature repeatedly these efforts at privatization called sort of Band-Aid measures.
Yeah, they're Band-Aids because they're not solving the real problem, which is neglect of infrastructure. I mean, it's very costly to run infrastructure. City of Port Angeles is a small town of about 20,000 people, where I'm on the council. Our budget is a little over $120,000. $100,000 of that budget is utilities. The utilities are far and away the biggest expense that we have. And we're running all of our own utilities once we take back the solid waste utility from a private company, and, you know, with the exception of telecommunications, which we need to work on and have public internet basically at this point. But it's expensive to run utilities. So the other thing about them is most of the expense is not in personnel. It's not in people who need to be paid every month, and thus you have to keep on track with, you know, that part of the budget. Instead, a lot of the expenses are things that you could put off for a year, maybe even a decade, maybe even half a century. You could put off maintenance on some of this infrastructure, and nobody's going to know until the infrastructure breaks or needs replaced. And so with poor asset management, it's not like they're intentionally cooking the books, but they're cooking the books and pretending like the utility is solvent, even when the pipes are rotting underground, but, you know, nobody sees that. So without good asset management, it's very hard to know how what the situation is for the utility. Now, as a public utility that's trying to do good asset management, sometimes the costs are higher than what a private company says it could run the utility for. The reason often is because the private utility is not going to do good asset management. They're going to let the system decay because, you know, that's not money for them. They want to pocket the money, not put it back into the ground and, you know, better pipes or newer pools or whatever the utility is. And then what they do is after there's a crisis, they go to usually the state regulatory body that governs utility rates, and they say, look, you know, if you want us to maintain the utility better so there aren't wildfires in California or, you know, toxic water in Michigan, then you need to let us raise the rates so that we can actually maintain the infrastructure. What they were really doing was they were pocketing that money before. I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? Like, you've got the cost of running the utility plus the private profit, and that's going to equal the cost of the utility ratepayers, you know, the residents of that community. And if you cut out that private profit, then the residents should have a better utility for less cost.
Both of you, Terry and Lindsay, are affiliated with the nonprofit group Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And I understand that community members or municipal officials will often come to CELDF with requests or concerns. It could be related to fracking operations, privatization of water, factory farms, or other threats. Do you see trends in the kinds of complaints or worries that people bring to the organization?
The trend I see is that there is a diminution of local democracy. What CELDEF principally does is we assist local grassroots organizations. We're only rarely approached by governmental officials, or perhaps we'll be approached by a maverick member of a village or city council. But the problem is that there is significant, at least historically significant, local power that we believe is unexercised. And when citizens start putting forth actual legally, potentially legally binding proposed local laws, it can make a difference. We have run into the continuing trend of state-level preemption of municipal power and also just the incredible distortion of our politics that is occasioned by dark money and campaign finance that definitely needs drastic reform. So the main thing that we have is a continuing and worsening democracy problem.
Lindsay and Terry, have I missed any major points or things that you'd like to talk about?
One thing I think needs to be understood is that a tremendous advantage that Lindsay was talking about in some respects of municipalization of a utility is that you have your rates set locally by people who are accessible, by politicians or decision makers who are accessible to the public. When you have a privatization, say, of a water utility, then regulation goes to the State Public Service or Public Utilities Commission, which is more often than not a gubernatorially appointed board that is, of course, subject at the state level to a barrage of lobbying and politics that is out of range when you're 150 miles away from Columbus, where the PUCO is, and your water utility is considering, your privately owned water utility is considering raising the rates. It's very difficult, short of just having legal intervention, which isn't necessarily enough, it's difficult to have an influencing effect on how those rates turn out. So one of the nightmare problems with owning a municipal landfill is solvable, and that is that you can reject certain waste streams, such as in Ohio, where disposal of radioactive fracking waste has become widespread and is completely legal in any of Ohio's landfills. But a municipal, governmentally operated one can simply refuse in response to public objections and pressure.
I have a final quick question for both of you. I read that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund conducted a study finding that economically disadvantaged cities are at increased risk under privatized systems. This comes as no surprise. Have you, both of you, noticed that in your work?
I don't have a comprehensive assessment of it. It makes sense intuitively, as that study found. You know, those cities that don't have as much resources are going to fall behind on asset management and going to then have a crisis where, you know, something breaks and it's like a really big deal to fix it, and probably be more at risk of privatization. So, you know, that pattern really goes back to this really, I mean, we've been talking about a topic that is not sexy at all. I mean, utilities are boring, and who wants to get into the weeds of, you know, are the pipes, you know, up to their state of good repair, or, you know, what's their useful life benchmark and all that stuff. It's also really wonky and becomes the purview of engineers way too fast. So it's very hard for people to access it and really understand, is the utility fiscally solvent? Is it being managed well? I mean, when I first came on the city council, I asked, you know, are we doing good asset management in our utilities? And the answer was, yes, just trust us. And then finally, we got a different public works director who was like, yeah, no, we're behind and we're working on catching up, but we need some really good plans. It's not easy at all. So I'm not trying to throw people under the bus and say that they just have to be more transparent. You know, when you're talking about maintaining pipes, for example, those are usually underneath streets, and you're trying to maintain the streets, and you don't want to cut the street to, you know, fix the sewer pipe, and then the next year cut the street to fix the water pipe. So you've got to coordinate all these different utilities with the street grid as well. It's complicated, but it can be done well, but it really has to be, I think, an inside and outside governance strategy. We need people on the inside, not just elected officials, but also staff, you know, particularly in utilities planning and engineering, who are on board with the idea that we're going to run it better because it's public. And we're going to run it for the long term, not just for the next five-year plan that we have, and then, you know, see what happens from there. It's part of the essence of what cities do is maintain infrastructure, and it's vital that we are involved in, you know, those of us inside government, and also those of us who are outside government pushing to make it better. It's got to be a strategy that's combined, and it's really about democracy, as Terry said.
Yes, and I want to say that both of you, for me and I believe our listening audience, have made utilities much more interesting than one usually might think. We want to thank you both for joining us today to demystify some of the privatization issues, and really thank you for the great work that you've been doing for many years.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Neighborhood. Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
India is part of a military alliance with Japan, Australia, and the United States against China, the quadrilateral security arrangement. Because India is part of the Quad, they changed the US Pacific Command to US Indo-Pacific Command.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on radical views from the Global South. The concept of Global South and Global North are not geographical terms, but rather describe a grouping of countries along economic lines. The Global South, previously called the Third World, is a term used to identify lower-income countries on one side of the so-called divide, the other side being the countries of the global north, with its enormous wealth and its institutions of power and control, the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank. The pandemic has created a kind of vaccine apartheid. Take Africa, for example. Only a few of its 1.3 billion people have been vaccinated. The haves of the global north keep most of the vaccines for themselves, while the have-nots of the global south scramble to get doses. In this program, Vijay Prashad presents perspectives and analyses rarely discussed in the media. Vijay Prashad is a historian, journalist, and educator. He's the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, based in Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, and India. Additionally, he's chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA Coups and Assassinations. I talked with him on November 18th, 2021. Good to see you again. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you. Come on.
Well, let's talk about the COP26 Glasgow summit. You were there. Greta Thunberg said COP26 even succeeded in watering down the blah, blah, blah. George Monbiot in The Guardian called it a suicide pact. What's your assessment of the conference?
You see, David, the first thing is, I wish that it were merely blah, blah, blah. In other words, I wish nothing came out of it. You know, that would actually be better than what did come out of it. Now, there's the expectation we have, which is we would like to go to some kind of post-carbon emissions world. And that certainly is not on the table. So if you're looking for a post-carbon emissions set of policy frameworks, that didn't happen. But something worse happened. I was looking very carefully at any conversation that might have taken place around agriculture. You see, this is important for many reasons. One is that we know that agriculture produces carbon emissions, but also methane emissions, the second great greenhouse gas. They didn't have a special day for agriculture. You know, there were special days for different issues like finance and so on. They had a day for nature, where in the discussions of the official COP, they talked about deforestation and so on. But they didn't talk directly about agriculture. Meanwhile,